This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
All right, when you think about James, though, we definitely need to highlight his contribution to the wonderful King James translation. And, you know, you can talk about how maybe in some places it didn't use the best, you know, Greek text or some of that. But I'm sure as your New Testament professors have indicated to you, if you look at it, and I know in years past when I was a student and did comparisons on some of the translations, that the King James in most instances is a doggone good piece of work. And it's one of the earliest team approaches to biblical translation. Now, Tyndale had worked with Coverdale, and there'd been some collaborative work on several. But I mean, this was 54 scholars, which is more along the lines of what we do in modern times, when the NIV or New American Standard, I mean, they just get a wide array of scholars, which is really prudent when you think about it, so no one particular bias gets included. You're checking and rechecking each other's work, you know, Old Testament scholars, New Testament, and so in basing it on the original languages. And, you know, it's just hard to improve on the beauty of that. And I know those of you that can remember in your childhood, just memorizing scripture passages out of the King James Bible, there's just a beauty to it that is kind of unsurpassed. So despite what we might like or dislike about King James, his great legacy is certainly this Bible that is forever associated with his name. All right. Charles I comes to the throne when King James dies, and Charles I is going to be the King of England, who is going to really have to come to blows with the Puritans eventually. Things are going to spin out of control as the English Civil War will emerge. He seems to, genuinely have, some religious convictions, but to kind of torn. It's kind of hard to peg Charles I, really. But he wanted to enforce Anglicanism and shared that same high view of the kingship that his father did. And he marries a Roman Catholic. And this really made him nervous again. I thought Mary Tudor had been dead for a long time. And, you know, they really got anxious about this. But I want you to notice, look on the slide, the daughter of Henry the Fourth. You talk about really making him nervous. Let's back the tape up. Henry the Fourth was the king of France who everyone had hoped would bring an end to the slaughter of the Huguenots in France. He was from Navarre, that territory which was on the border between France and Spain. He was a Protestant. And in one of the first acts that he makes after he becomes the new king of France is this leader among the Protestants. He converts to Catholicism to bring peace. This is a palm branch to the Catholic nobles. And then he passes this Edict of Nantes, again, you remember that, which allowed for 100 safe places for the Huguenots. So these two things, it says, all right, Huguenot worship is legal, but I'm officially going to be Roman Catholic. And he was just in his own way trying to do what he had to do to survive, I guess. Well, it's his daughter now that Charles I marries. Well, it's always good to marry somebody from the royal household of another country. That was nice. But remember, we saw what happened in Scotland over this, the French connection in Scotland with Mary, Queen of Scots, and her French husband, and the connection to Roman Catholicism. So the English and the Scots had a history of not being fond of the French, not the least of which is they are committed Roman Catholics. Now, he himself, you know, is a loyal Anglican. It's very clear he's not trying to bring Roman Catholicism back. But the very fact that he had wed this Roman Catholic princess really made the Puritans anxious. Well, when we back to our chart that we've looked at here several times, if we think about James I and Charles I, we use the phrase enforced Episcopalianism here. And again, with their view, the divine right of kings, they were not willing to listen to the Puritans. They really didn't want to listen to Parliament very much either. And basically to enforce uniformity throughout their domain, they were much more heavy-handed than Elizabeth had been. One of the reasons the Puritan movement had proliferated in England during Elizabeth, even though, as we saw, there were times where she would arrest some of them. A lot of her bishops were lenient. But by the time James I and Charles I come on the scene, there's more and more persecution. These Protestants losing their pulpits, some of them being imprisoned. But it's during the reign of these three sovereigns that the Puritan movement, is strong in England during that period. Well, an individual who would become notoriously despised, I should say, among the Puritans was William Laud, the new Archbishop of Canterbury. In 1628, in his oppression of the Puritans, and it's during his era that some of these separatist independents are going to make their way to the New World. And during this time, if you can remember your American history, 1630 is the Massachusetts Bay Colony. These are English Congregationalists that make their way to America. In many ways, to escape the oppression under Archbishop Laud. But many of the moderates are still staying in the church, but Laud opposes these Puritan lectureships. He's trying to shut those down. He continues to encourage the Sunday sports, which angers the Puritans. But we'll give him credit, he didn't burn his opponents. They suffered imprisonment or may have lost their livings, but he wasn't just putting them to death right and left. So I guess we should give credit where credit is due. I think at this point in time, the English had figured out that doesn't accomplish anything. And sadly to say, you know, if they were convinced that it did, who knows? It may have continued to go on.
Was his beef mainly with the separatists?
Non-separatist Puritans, or both?
It would be both to the extent that he was committed under Charles I to enforcing the Book of Common Prayer on every Protestant in England. It was against the law to hold what were known as conventicles. These were religious gatherings where the Book of Common Prayer was not utilized. That was against the law. And so Law was pushing for that. And, of course, one of the challenges that, he's going to face is there are lots of Puritans around, and there's some in Parliament. But he was definitely what we call a high church Episcopalian. And you might even put him in this is a later category of the Anglo-Catholic tradition. Now, the Anglo-Catholic tradition, we're not going to talk about it in the purview of this course, but what's known as the Oxford Movement in England as you move into the 19th century. And there was a movement among Catholics. And I think I may have mentioned a bit about this last week. Those among the arch defenders of the Anglican settlement now was that, the Roman Catholic Church and the reality of the Roman Catholic Church has been twisted by Trent, and we are the genuine Catholic Church. It has continued. We preserve the Catholic faith from ancient times, and so really viewing Anglicanism as the true church, if you would, and still willing to, in some in the Anglo-Catholic tradition, willing to say the Roman Catholic Church is a part of the true church, but that we're the ones who are genuinely practicing the genuine ancient faith. So that's going to be an ongoing... You have high church Anglicans and low church Anglicans. And your low church Anglicans would be look more like the Puritans, you know, and not to emphasize as much the liturgy of the church. But there were moderates who stayed in the church, but now more of these radicals are going to leave. And also under law in Scotland, by 1637, they're going to attempt to impose the prayer book on Scotland, and riots break out in Scotland. And this is going to be the beginnings, the early phases of the English Civil War. They try to do that. Well, you remember John Knox, when he came back to England the second time, what was it, 1558, I think, you know, his sermon sparked a riot. Well, here we have another riot in Scotland, where they're the official reading of the legislation pushing the prayer book on the Scots. Well, the Scots are going to rebel, and they're not going to submit to that, and they sign the National Covenant. This is a very famous document in Scottish history. There's a facsimile of it right there inside St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh. The original is in a museum, but this was a document. It originally had been adopted way back in 1580, but here a re-signing of this national commitment, basically to reaffirm the Reformed faith, that we're committed to the Reformed faith, we're not going to compromise that. And there in the court, in the courtyard of the little Greyfriars Church, and you can see it kind of in the down at the foot of well, it's further than that from Edinburgh Castle, the little Greyfriars Church. There's a little marker there where they the Scots signed this document, and basically they refuse to change anything in the Church of Scotland until Parliament is called together to discuss these matters, because they realized that there were a lot of Puritan sympathizers in Parliament. Because one of the things that Charles I did is that he had refused to call Parliament. In fact, for 11 years, he operated unilaterally without Parliament. From 1629 to 1640, he did not even bother to call Parliament into session. So he was getting his will and his way throughout England. All right, so this national covenant, the Scots in effect are signing this with their own blood. You know, we're not going to compromise on this, and to protesting Charles's policies. Well, the First Bishops' War erupts in 1639, and essentially the way the Scots understood this, this was a rebellion, and we're going to abolish episcopacy. We're going to get rid of any prelates in the church. The First Bishops' War. Well, because of the cost of maintaining the army to fight against the Scots, he is actually forced to call Parliament in 1639. And so he calls them into session. This is known, actually 1639, 1640, right in there. They meet for a very short time. In fact, that's why it's called the Short Parliament. If you ever read about the Short Parliament in English history, it's this little brief period. He calls them together, but as soon as Parliament gets together, they start coming up with a list of grievances against the king. Well, you can imagine, they haven't been in session for 11 years. And now, all of a sudden, here are all of our issues. Well, you can guess what Charles did. He immediately disbands Parliament, dismisses them when they started to coming up with these grievances. But one of the things that this did, when Parliament, even the Short Parliament, was in session, it gave the opponents of the crown time to organize. And they began to talk among themselves that we have got to get rid of King Charles, and we cannot live under this kind of oppression. Well, by 1640, the Second Bishops' War, the Scottish army actually marches into England. And at this point, the king is compelled to call the Long Parliament. And the English Parliament at this point is has officially allying itself with the Scots, and realize that they are going to have to deal with the king. The king makes his way to Oxford during the English Civil War. This is where he's holed up during this period, as the Puritans and the Parliament have taken over London. The king is now over in Oxford and made this his headquarters. In fact, on the last trip we were on, we noticed the building where King Charles was there in Oxford. All right. Well, he calls a long parliament. And one of the things that is issued during this time, I don't even think I have it up as a bullet point, but what's known as the root and branch petition, the root and branch petition of 1640. This is a long list of grievances now that the Long Parliament issues. And they're getting pretty bold now. You can see they've already seen the handwriting on the wall. We're going to have to push this. They call for the abolition of episcopacy, root and branch. We want to jerk it out by the root. And so the Puritans and the Long Parliament have got their moment in the sun. And in 1641, the Parliament passes the Grand Remonstrance to the King, outlines the problems. And at this point, they call for a synod to meet, and that there be a gathering of the divines in England to work toward the further reform of the church, to deal with the issues of the ecclesiastical corruption under the royal hegemony. And Parliament appoints a committee on religion to deal with, now with Parliaments taking over the country as the English Civil War breaks out. And they're deciding that we're going to call for a committee now to begin the process of how are we going to reform the Church of England. Well, Alexander Henderson in Scotland calls for a new confession of faith for England and Scotland. Now, the Scots had John Knox's Scots Confession all the way back from 1560. But he says we need a new confession of faith. And so he's suggesting that the Long Parliament begin to do this. So an assembly of divines is going to be called together by 1642, and this will be the famous Westminster Assembly, where they are going, these Puritans once and for all are going to be able to put down in writing their ideas about what the ecclesiology in England ought to be, the doctrines that we hold, and that kind of thing. Well, the English Civil War now is unfolding, 1642 to 1649. You basically have the king, Charles I, and the nobility, and those that are still, those that are... have strong views about the Church of England and want to continue to maintain that established church, versus the Parliament, more the middle class, these Puritans, and now these separatists. And so the parliamentary army is going to have a diversity of folks involved in that. So the Scots are now joining with the English Parliament against Charles the First. And this, in many ways, is the climax of Puritanism in England. This is the climax of the Puritanism in England. The assembly at Westminster, now in 1643 to 48, where they finally have got their window of opportunity. And now in 1643, an ordinance is introduced into the Commons calling for this assembly of divines to reform the church without the consent of the king. The king had not been willing to allow for the parliament in the reform of the church. And their commission is to settle the issues of liturgy, discipline, and government of the church. To settle the issues of liturgy, discipline, and government of the church. So now all of it's coming into play. Not only their objections to the Book of Common Prayer, their objection to episcopacy, and also their concern for church structure and discipline. So the assembly is now going to convene. Their first task that was given to them was to revise the 39 Articles. All right, the 39 Articles ever since Elizabeth's reign had been the official confession of faith of the English Church, and this was the task that had been given to them. But as they began to work on revising the 39 Articles, they only are able to make progress on revising the first 15 before another assignment is given to them. And here now their attention is going to be turned toward not just a revision, but a new work, a new confession of faith for the English at this point. Well, the Solemn League and Covenant is signed in 1643. This is the official alliance, which had already begun in practice, between the Scots and the English Parliament. The Solemn League and Covenant was a public commitment to preserve the Reformed religion and to get rid of popery and prelacy. To preserve the Reformed religion and get rid of popery and prelacy. And this was approved by the Scottish and the English parliaments. And it was actually subscribed by the Assembly in the Westminster Assembly, and also by the Scottish commissioners that were there, part of the Westminster Assembly. There were Scots representatives that were invited to participate in the Westminster Assembly who had the right of the floor to speak, but they did not have the vote. Because even though James I is the head of state for both England and Scotland, there were still separate parliaments. Even though he had become James I of England, he was still James VI of Scotland. You just had a unity of the crown in one person, but you had separate parliaments. Okay, if that makes sense. So the Scots, they've made this military alliance to preserve the Reformed faith. So Scots are invited to participate in the Assembly's deliberations, but are not able to vote, but the right to speak. All right, the Assembly draws up a form of government, and as you might guess, it's Presbyterian in its structure. The independents were not pleased with that, and some of the interesting debate that took place there. In fact, one of the famous paintings, if you want to see a copy of that painting, come by my office sometime. I have a large reprint of this painting. This is where the independents are asserting the liberty of conscience. As we're going to reform the church, let's don't enforce Presbyterianism. If we're going to replace Episcopacy, why do we have to replace it with an absolute Presbyterianism? Why can't we allow liberty of conscience on church government? These were some of the most tense-filled discussions, which is rather odd to our thinking, I guess, in some ways, because you think when an assembly of divines get together, the biggest debates are going to be about these heavy theological issues, but really church government. They were rather uniform in their perspectives on the theology. There were differences, and they hammered them out. And one of the reasons that the Westminster Confession is as good a document as it is because, at least in some parts of it, the moderate tone that's there, there was a balancing of perspectives there. But now, even though the form of government that the assembly produces, we'll go back to that slide, is Presbyterian, it is never going to be fully enforced in England. Even though the Presbyterian Puritans get their day in the spotlight, this will never become law in England. So Presbyterianism never really takes root in any official way, but at least this is a recommendation that the Assembly of Divines is making to Parliament now to do that. Also a directory for worship, and this was intended as a replacement for the Book of Common Prayer. Again, they were not going to revise it, they were going to replace it with a directory for worship, which Presbyterians have had directories of worship throughout the years. American Presbyterians have, and it's interesting. Sometimes there are set prayers in the old Presbyterian directory for worship, which look rather Anglican-like, and you can kind of see some of the historical connections. But the main point, though, at least in the directory of worship, these are suggested prayers, but the minister is free to use his own, and so it was a directory, if you would, and some guidelines. But for certainly, baptismal services, marriage ceremonies, that kind of thing, very, very helpful. All right, consensus in the assembly on many things, especially the confessions and the catechisms as they draw that up together. The thing to remember, though, that this Assembly of Divines, which was gathered, it was not an official ecclesiastical synod in terms of having any kind of churchly authority. It was only to give its advice to the Parliament. Okay, because don't for a minute have in your mind, oh great, we're moving towards separation of church and state. No, Parliament's going to call the shots. They just don't want the king to do it. But still, we want to have a Church of England. And they just wanted it to be to look a little differently. All right, to give advice, and in fact, they were actually forbidden to exercise any jurisdiction or authority at all. Notice the title page of the published version. The humble advice of the Assembly of Divines, now by authority of Parliament, sitting at Westminster, concerning confession of faith with quotation and text of Scripture annexed. Presented by them lately to both Houses of Parliament. Printed at London, reprinted at Edinburgh, 1647. So this is the work that they finally produce. And I'll give Parliament credit. The original draft was given to them, and they gave it back to the divines and said, we want Scripture texts, proof texts for everything. So all those lovely footnotes we have in the Westminster Confession are a challenge. Some years ago, Dr. Kelly and I worked with one other gentleman on a modern version of the larger catechism. You talk about a royal headache. What we had to do, well, not only is it the biggest document they produced, it's much bigger than the Confession of Faith, the larger catechism, we tried to collate all the scripture footnotes from all the different versions of that among Presbyterians in England and in America. Oh, you just have no idea. But the point is well taken that at this point, the Puritans, they were very clear about the fact we want to be sure that our doctrine is based upon the teaching of the Scriptures. And, you know, I'd be the first to admit there are a few of those footnotes that you could argue are pushing the point just a little bit. And we don't need to go into that. But the principle was, and as part of the reason there have been so many modifications over the years, some of the later Presbyterians, man, I can come up with a better Scripture proof text than that one, than the Assembly had on this particular point. But usually what you have now in versions that most of us are used to are compilations of a lot of the footnotes. So we have a lot more than the original version did. But continued in that. Well, let me go back there. All right, because I want to mention Samuel Rutherford because he's an important player and it raises an issue about the Assembly. Yes. I'm sorry.
I'm not.
Pardon me.
Sorry. Could you maybe talk about the title Divines?
Sure.
Those of us who didn't grow up, and understand it.
No, it was just a term that was used for clergy at that time.
Okay.
Yeah, a divine. In other words, they're students of divinity.
Okay.
Where we get our like divinity schools. Which we, you know, there are still divinity schools. I guess most of the universities usually will have the graduate schools of divinity. But yeah. I know, it does seem rather pompous term there.
Just curious.
Yeah, if I was ever called a divine, my son would say, who are you talking about? All right, Rutherford. He's one of these Scottish representatives. There were actually only eight of them. He could talk, but couldn't vote. And he was there along with the other 120 or so divines. There's roughly a group of 130. Although they averaged attendance, we understand about 60 to 80 of each day as they would meet together in the assembly. And one of the, I'll have to tell you about a cool thing. I don't think I mentioned this. I got to do on my trip a few weeks ago. If you go into Westminster Abbey, you can go to Henry VIII's chapel, which is a very beautiful section, the chapel of Westminster Abbey, and that's where the assembly started. They actually met in a little area, and then they moved to Henry VII chapel, where the Westminster Assembly met. But then, as winter came along, it got cold, they moved to what's known as the Jerusalem Chamber, which is a number of rooms back into an area of Westminster Abbey. You can't get in there at all. Whenever I've been, you just can't. In fact, I've asked, just to show you how obscure it is, for so I've even asked a steward at Westminster Abbey where it was one time. He didn't even know. Well, this last time, one of the stewards, when we asked about the Westminster, what the room called the Jerusalem Chamber, he said, "You must be Presbyterian, because they're the only people who even know about this room." And he couldn't take a group, but he took one other gentleman, a minister, and we got to go back into the actual Jerusalem Chamber. It's the only room in the entire Westminster Abbey that has a fireplace. I forget which king it was. One of the kings of England died in that room because they're trying to keep him warm in the last hours of his life. But it's a small room. In fact, if you look at this painting, you'll notice it looks like they're kind of crowded. I don't know what your image is of this 100, you know, it's only about, like, say, 60 to 80 every day. The Jerusalem Chamber is a room no bigger than this. Not much bigger than this, as they were crowded in. Maybe it's a little bigger. But a fireplace on one side, and they just crowded into that and with the number of people in the room. So that's a realistic painting there. And I didn't have a chance to download that slide, but he did allow me to take one picture in there. So I got a picture of the Jerusalem Chamber. I thought I could get some brownie points. You know, I came back and I told my colleagues on the faculty, I got to go into the Jerusalem. They said, "You're kidding. We've been," and then Doug Kelly said, "Well, I got to go in there once too." I said, all right. I have no bragging rights to that. But Samuel Rutherford, let's talk about him. And here you have a sense of the political overtones of the assembly and why Charles and the Anglicans were concerned about where some of the Puritan reform was going. But his famous little book, Lex Rex, Law is King, A Dispute for the Just Prerogative of King and People, this is where he attacks the absolutist views of the monarchy that had been prevalent in both James and Charles. That this notion of absolute control of the king, this is not legitimate. And he also will argue he's one of those tightly wound Scottish Presbyterian types. Notice his second little book, The Divine Right of Church Government and Excommunication. That it's Presbyterianism or nothing. And some Presbyterians would agree with that, some wouldn't. But not that it's not biblical, but some want to say it's the only one. But he certainly did. But those are two works, and here's is one of the individuals, and we don't have time to talk about the writings. But there's been a lot of work on the divines, and people read their writings. And one study I did years ago, I was just curious. I was looking at, I don't know about you, but those of you who read the Confession are familiar with it. One of my favorite chapters is chapter 1 on Holy Scripture. I mean, it's hard to beat that statement. On the authority of Scripture, and I did a study on looking at what the Westminster Divines in their writings, what their teachings were on Scripture, and it was rather fascinating. And you could just see how many of them had been thinking through these issues: how do we understand the doctrine of Scripture and its role? And just fascinating. So there's a lot of stuff that's out there. Usually the titles of their books are usually a long paragraph in length, if you ever look at the 17th century Puritan writings, but there continues to be a lot of interest in them. Well, 1646, 1648, those documents are produced. Yes?
I just want to ask, the Westminster Confession is a product of the English Puritan divines, and the Scottish divines had input but no vote. Is that right?
That's right. Because it was an assembly which was authorized by the English Parliament, right, and they invited the Scots to participate. Yeah. But and here's the other twist, Ralph, in history. Mm-hmm. Who ends up, though, adopting the Westminster Confession but the Scots, and the English never did? Because the Scots ended up adopting Westminster to replace the Scots Confession. Also, Shanisha, just for if you run across this, there was a document in Ireland called the Irish Articles of 1615. which had been utilized in there are parts of the Westminster Confession that clearly seem to reflect some of what had been in those Irish Protestants too. So there had been
some Protestant thinking about articulating their doctrines of faith. Certainly they were aware of what the Scots Confession said, but the Westminster, I remember hearing Gordon Clark. I don't know if that name means anything to you. He was a famous old Presbyterian philosopher. I had him in college, but he made a good point and made an impression on me as a young man about this. He said, the thing that impresses you about Westminster is so many of the other Reformed confessions up to this point, if you look at them, had been written by one or two individuals. See, Melanchthon had done Augsburg, the Heidelberg Catechism had those two contributors. Now, the Canons of Dort had been a corporate work, although it was dealing with a specific set of objections. But here they had a wide open venue, and rather than just meeting over a number of months, they met over 4 or 5 years. So they had a long, and there really has never been any other kind of assembly quite like it in terms of its duration and the breadth of the different doctrines it's dealt with. And it's the reason why I think it's kind of stood the test of time. It's not a perfect document. And I joke, we talk about taking exceptions. We had one of our professors, I won't name on which campus, when he joined the faculty at RTS, he gave us 7 pages of exceptions to the Westminster Confession. Now, they were minor little jot and tittle details. It wasn't anything substantive really there. But it's not a perfect document, but the reason it stood the test of time, I think, is really the historical context of it and who participated and over a long period of time. So it was very sober reflection on important doctrines. Well, I won't pontificate on that anymore. You probably don't need to be convinced about that. Not perfect, but very useful. All right, well, after the English Civil War continues on, Cromwell becomes the head of the army, and what became known as the New Model Army. He had all these Puritans of Presbyterian or independent convictions. The parliamentary army will triumph. 1649, I have on there, on the bullet point, Charles I surrenders, but within 3 years his head's going to be chopped off, and he will be executed. And now, it's one thing to say we want to get rid of something. I think I've mentioned that theme number. It's another thing, what are we going to put in its place? And England struggled, and there are many that wanted Cromwell to be the new king. And he resisted that. And there were a lot of struggles going on within Parliament. You may have heard of the term in English history, the Rump Parliament. That was group of the Parliament for a season who tried to get themselves elected as a permanent body, not elected for terms. But finally, Cromwell will dismiss the Long Parliament. And in this political vacuum, they try to establish a commonwealth or a republic, if you would. And he becomes Lord Protector. But Charles surrenders. Then eventually, one of the things toward the end of the English Civil War, it shows you where the Scots were on this. He actually aligns, Charles makes overtures to the Scots and promises them, if you will fight with me against Cromwell, I will guarantee you that I will establish Presbyterianism in England. And some of the Scots fall prey to that, so he marches his army into Scotland, defeats them. Then the infamous massacre in Ireland. That's really probably the chief black mark on Cromwell's career. Now, there had been a history behind that. During both the Elizabethan times and during James I, there had been a lot of English colonists that had made their way into Ireland, particularly in Northern Ireland. And if he'd done that in about 30 years previously, there had been a civil war there, and the Irish had just brutally killed a bunch of the Scots in Ireland, in the English settlers there. So you wonder if Cromwell's in some way kind of getting even, but the anyway, he takes his army into Ireland and defeats an army there, and then there's one particular area where there are a couple of thousand men who are unarmed, and because of his concern that they may eventually rebel, he just has them all brutally murdered, just killed. Unarmed people. Just whoosh. And, you know, things were pretty brutal in these years. But if you ever heard of Cromwell and the Irish Massacre, that was taking place during that time. Well, Cromwell was a rather effective leader, kind of rather charismatic in his persona, and so the people were kind of drawn to them. But the monarchy obviously is abolished. The House of Lords is abolished. Some of the radical groups began to emerge, such as the Quakers and others, during the time of Cromwell. And as many point out, this was probably the closest during the time of the Protectorate in Cromwell, is the time that you England comes the closest to religious toleration that it would until the time of William and Mary. And basically, Cromwell still wanted a national church. Now, he was a congregationalist by conviction, or an independent. No bishops or no Book of Common Prayer. He wanted all Protestants tolerated except the Quakers. For some reason, nobody liked the Quakers. You know, they were kind of the radicals. But he wanted to see all forms of Protestantism tolerated in England. And he even had a desire for, you know, Roman Catholics, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, and Independents to get along. And again, wanting to see if he could establish some kind of precedent for toleration. Well, after Cromwell dies in 1658, he's followed by his son Richard, who's very ineffective. And he loses control of Parliament. And he was not the same kind of pious man that Cromwell was. So Cromwell apparently took his, you know, Puritan faith seriously. But the restoration of the monarchy. Well, I'll just say something about George Fox. I'm getting ahead of myself. Here I mentioned the Quakers established George Fox. Is one of these separatist types who abandoned the church. He was imprisoned for a season, but began to organize some of his followers, and did some mission work in Ireland and also in North America. And of course, we know the Quakers would come over here in some good numbers, especially to Pennsylvania. But distinctive about the Quakers, they were given this name. It was a pejorative term that, you know, in some of their monthly meetings, as it were, that some of the Quakers have been seen to be shaking. The Quakers are friends, as they would be called, but no minister or sacraments, and no military service, no oaths. So you kind of see a connection with some Anabaptist type thinking to a certain extent, but Cromwell was not too impressed with them, and they were rather persecuted in England. Well, Charles II is restored to the throne. I mentioned the failure of Richard Cromwell. In 1660, the restoration, when you hear that term, and you know, if things had not been bad enough, by the time Charles II comes to the throne, they're going to really be serious about trying to stamp out or suppress Puritanism. Well, you can imagine why. He comes back out of exile, and he had spent time in France and in Holland, and he makes his way back now into England. Since Richard Cromwell's ineffective, there was a party that felt, and even some of the Puritans really felt like it was wrong to chop off Charles I's head. You know, we do not have the right to kill the king. God has put him over us, and we got issues with him. But so some of the Puritans were even instrumental in the restoration of Charles II to the monarchy, because again, they were loyal to the crown, and But they were sorely disappointed in terms of the direction. But you can imagine, given the context of where the Puritans had just rebelled and killed his own father, he is not about to be lenient toward Puritans if he has the authority to oppress them. And so Charles II is going to, during the period of the Restoration, not only the crown back in its very prominent position, but the restoration of episcopacy throughout England. And during the time of Charles II, a parliament is restored to a situation similar to the way it was before the English Civil War. Charles himself, it appears, was more personally inclined to Roman Catholicism. In fact, in the last hours of his life, in the 1685, he will officially be received back into the Roman Catholic Church. Now, he was rather secretive about this to a certain extent. I mean, he didn't just flaunt it in front of the English people. In fact, ironically, even though, you know, he had those sympathies and he's enforcing Episcopalianism, he actually wanted to continue with the toleration that Cromwell had put in place to tolerate Catholics, the English, and the English Church. And so, but in 1662, an act of uniformity is put in place. And many of these Protestants are not willing to line themselves up with that. And 2,000 of them lose their pulpits. So now the Protestants, these Puritan types, go from the place of advantage now to disadvantage. And 2 years later, 1664, the Conventicle Act. And this is where meetings over five persons were forbidden unless they used the Book of Common Prayer. And the next year, the 5 Mile Act. No non-conforming minister could be within 5 miles of the city or teach unless he were committed to not overturning the established church and the restored monarchy. But then he begins to shift focus a little bit. By 1672, there was a declaration of indulgence. And he's wanting to tolerate both Roman Catholics and dissenters. And so he realizes that this is not working. And some of the more famous Puritans get put out of their pulpits. For example, after the break, we'll talk about John Bunyan, Richard Baxter, some of the people we associate with the kind of the high point of Puritanism lose their pulpits during the time of the Restoration. And so they are on the outs. Well, this declaration of indulgence, and this shows you where Parliament was, to tolerate Catholics and some of these dissenters, but Parliament repeals it because they're concerned if we're going to maintain peace in England, we need to have uniformity. And actually make an oath, what's known as the Test Act, required of anyone who would serve in the military in England, had to take an oath to the Crown and to the Church of England. So you can see how it's marginalizing these Puritans, not able to participate in the government, in the military, the Book of Common Prayers being pushed on them. And Bunyan actually is released from prison in 1672, with this declaration of indulgence. He'll have a short imprisonment a little bit later on. But you can see Charles II struggling with these issues. And as I mentioned, in his final hours, received back into the Roman Catholic Church. Well, when we come back, I want to do a little section on Richard Baxter. And if you don't know much about Richard Baxter, I think there are some ways you're going to really be attracted to him. In his lifetime, this is one of the ministers who loses his pulpit. By the time he's in his 40s, he is going to be the most popular minister in all of England. And the reasons for that. And a very intriguing individual. But we'll talk about Baxter when we come back.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.